It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, the Keystone XL pipeline bill failed to pass the Senate last night. We'll get the latest in our weekly conversation with Paul Singer from USA Today.
But first, hunters across the state are gearing up for the annual deer hunt, which begins on Saturday and runs for 9 days.
A few changes take hold this year, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wants you to be aware of them before you head out to the woods this weekend.
Joining us now is Kevin Wanfang. He's a big game ecologist in the Bureau of Wildlife Management at the DNR. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So something's different this year from last. What's changed?
Well, that can't be answered very quickly. There are quite a few changes in our deer season structure, our deer management zones. We've got some new boundaries for our deer management units across the state.
Has that changed from last year? How are the zones different?
Well, we used to have about 135 deer management units, and they followed, for the most part, roads and rivers around the state. And as I think a lot of your listeners are going to know, that we went through a deer management unit review over the last couple of years, and one of those recommendations was that we try to simplify the boundaries of our deer management units. So we've done that, and our units now simply follow the county lines in most cases.
Now, something from last year has gone away, the Earn a Buck program. Tell us what that was and why the change.
Well, actually, Earn a Buck has been gone since the 2011 season. So Earn a Buck used to be that before you could shoot a buck, you had to shoot an antlerless deer. This was a management strategy, especially in the chronic wasting disease zone, to try to lower deer numbers, to slow the spread of that disease. And, and it was used across the state and other areas, and it was a very, very effective tool, but in some cases too effective. So that went away through actually legislation. The ability to have earn a buck seasons has gone away, but we do still have something that we call bonus buck. And it gives a hunter the opportunity to shoot an antlerless deer, and they can get a sticker, and then they buy another tag that gives them the privilege to shoot another antlered buck. But they don't have to shoot a doe first to do that. They can do that any time throughout the season.
Now, in northern Wisconsin, the herd is down, I gather, perhaps due to the rough winter last year. How has that changed what hunters can do up there?
Well, the biggest part of that is that it's a buck-only season for most hunters. So we go through a process every year where we get public feedback and we do our population estimates and, we look at what's out there. The backbone of Wisconsin's deer management program is a variable harvest quota. So when we want to have more deer on the landscape, we don't shoot as many does so that they produce fawns and the population goes up. And when we want to have fewer deer out there, we shoot more of those does and the population goes down. So we are in a herd building mode in the northern part of the state. And as a result of that, and because of those bad winters, and there's other issues going on out there too, but primarily because we've had two very, very tough back-to-back winters out there, we have no antlerless deer hunting in whole or in part of 19 counties this year.
There is a lot of snow on the ground in northern Wisconsin already. How do you see that affecting the season as it begins?
Well, we've already heard from a fair number of people that said they're not even going to bother because they're worried that they won't even be able to get into their cabin. As of this morning, as I understand it, in the town of Guile, they have 71 inches of snow on the ground. So, I mean, that's over a lot of people's heads. Those deer are virtually going to be swimming through snow.
Right, not even Thanksgiving. It's a lot of snow on the ground.
Oh, my goodness. And so, we know that there's going to be people that that don't even bother. The folks that do go out there, it's going to be tough hunting. There's no question about it. And frankly, it would have been a pretty tough hunting even without the snow because deer numbers are down. We were projecting it was going to be a difficult year, comparatively, I guess, to get a deer in the northern part of the state. But that's even going to be, much worse now. And, unfortunately, we're going into, if this continues, we're going to have 3 years back-to-back-to-back of, very tough winters. And they've already done a number on the deer population in the north, and so you can only imagine what one more year that might do.
Now, that affects the deer herd for certain. Does that affect anything else in the way the operations run?
As far as how we manage deer?
Mm-hmm. And or, bureaucratic things, the fees that might come in from hunting licenses.
Well, I'm not going to dive into the fee part of it because I really am no expert on that corner of the world. But certainly, it will affect how we manage deer in the north. We've already been in a herd growth situation, and that's tough to do when you get these winters. You know, it's very likely the hunters will change. Some of those hunters will change where they hunt for a few years. We may see more people hunting in the southern part of the state where we always seem to have a pretty good abundance of deer. I can guarantee you that in some of the counties up there, we will continue to have buck-only seasons so that the antlerless deer that do make it through the year are able to reproduce and increase that population. So there's no question about it. It will affect our management practices for the next few years.
Now, this is the first year that the state held a crossbow hunting season. How will that affect the available deer herd for gun hunters next week?
Well, again, it's a little bit tough to say at this point because we don't have harvest information for the early archery season. So, you know, we had about 64,000 crossbow licenses were sold this year. Now, some of those were just folks that used to hunt with a regular bow and they switched. Some of those are new hunters. So we're going to evaluate that harvest after the season. We'll be able to put some surveys out there to the people that participated and look at our harvest data. When a person registers a deer, and, you know, deer registration is still mandatory in the state, we'll be able to harvest, you know, mine some of that information out of the harvest and see how it really affected things. But as of this point, it's a little hard to really tell.
And we're still a few days out from gun hunting season, but license sales are down about 11,000 compared to this time last year. What is your take on those numbers? Do they mean anything?
I wouldn't speculate on those quite yet either. You know, our license sales are kind of a funny thing. It's like Christmas for a lot of people. They wait till the very last minute. We sell about 50% of our licenses this week. You know, as I said, though, earlier, there are some folks that hunt in the far northern part of the state, and they've expressed that, you know, why even bother? They can't even get into the cabin. So it makes perfect sense that they would probably wait and see what the situation might be. And, you know, we also have folks out there that, I guess for a lack of a better way to put it, they're kind of a fair weather hunter. When they see deer numbers way up, our license sales go up, and when deer numbers are down, our license sales can go down. So, you know, there is some of that going on out there, but quite frankly, they're not that far off from what they were last year. I think we're at about 95% of the pace of what we were last year. So when it's over, it's over. We'll see what happens. And we do have seasons after the regular gun season, so folks can participate in a couple of different hunts out there still with a gun. So I would anticipate that some of those folks that can't get out this week, they may still want to try later into the December seasons.
Kevin, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to Kevin Wallenfang, big game ecologist in the Bureau of Wildlife Management at the DNR. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Yesterday, the Senate voted against the Keystone XL pipeline by one vote, rejecting Mary Landrieu's plea to pass it and maybe give her a better chance at keeping her Senate seat.
Reports say that President Obama will announce his executive action on immigration tomorrow evening, which is expected to block the deportation of maybe 5 million undocumented immigrants. Republicans in Congress are planning ways to thwart that action.
And the current lame duck Congress is headed towards another fiscal cliff that could produce one last stalemate before Republicans settle into a majority in both the House and the Senate next year.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to hear from you guys. How are you?
All right. So lame duck session. Is it always this hopping, this time of session?
Well, you know, I think there was once upon a time when people didn't come back after the elections and do anything. You know, these sessions are basically routinely at this point convened for the purposes of doing must-pass bills. As you were mentioning, the fiscal cliff being one of them, you know, the government runs out of money December 11th, so they got to get that done. But there's a lot on the plate this week.
Well, and this Keystone XL thing, it's been hanging out there for what? 5-6 years, I don't know. Why, you've touched on this a little in the past, why did this vote all of a sudden happen now in this session?
The vote happened all of a sudden because on December 6th there will be a runoff election for the Louisiana Senate seat. Senator Mary Landrieu, a Democrat from Louisiana, was not able to get 50% in that race on November 4th. So she and the Republican, a guy named a congressman named Bill Cassidy, go into a head-to-head runoff on December 6th, and Cassidy is heavily favored. So this was Mary Landrieu's Hail Mary pass. I mean, she took this thing to the floor and said, let's see if we can get enough Democratic support to pass it. It's a very popular project for Louisiana, you know, shipping basically a bunch of oil from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. So she figured she'd give it a shot, and she lost. So they'll take this up again in the next Congress, but pretty much likely without Mary Landrieu.
Yeah. Was there a thought that even if they did pass this, she had a shot to win this election?
Yeah, it's a tough – I mean, it's going to be hard for her. It's just going to be very hard for her. Obama is so unpopular. President Obama is so unpopular in Louisiana. Democrats are not a good brand down there. She's had a couple of problems, mostly that she appears to live more in D.C. than she does in Louisiana. It's not clear she actually has a house of her own in Louisiana. And the die was pretty much cast against her all along. Her best shot was in November. There was enough people on the ballot to dilute the supporters of her opponents, and she could have conceivably, you know, gotten the best of that election. But it seems much harder to do. I don't think she breaks, you know, 45% in the runoff.
Republicans, for the most part, have wanted this Keystone XL thing to pass. I'm going to put words in their mouth and guess they don't want Mary Landrieu to win. How did they respond to this effort to bring this to a vote?
Well, they all voted for it. You know, their version of this thing was, in order to get it to the Senate floor, of course, it had to pass the House. And so they put Bill Cassidy as the front runner, sort of the front man for the bill in the House. So for them, it's fine. You know, it's a Cassidy-Landrieu bill if they want. He'll take as much credit as she will. You know, they said basically, well, this is not the way to do these things, but if this is what we need to do to get it passed, they all voted for it.
And is this thing going to pass, do you think, when the new Congress convenes a Republican majority on the Senate side?
You know, I honestly don't know. I mean, the president has threatened to veto it. I am doubtful that he'll have a veto-proof majority. You know, there will be 54 Republicans at this point, I think. So, you know, if Mary Landrieu loses, I think there'll be 55, although check my math. So maybe they only need five more Democrats to join them. They may be able to squeeze that out. It's kind of hard to tell. You know, they've got some Democratic support. There are Democrats who will endorse this idea, but apparently not enough.
So this could lead to some more internal dissension, maybe among Democrats.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, there is a very strong environmental caucus amongst the Democrats who say this is a bad idea. They think it is simply a way to promote more, you know, use of carbon fuels. They think that the mining process for this oil out of the tar sands in Canada is particularly unclean, and they think it doesn't help U.S. energy supply at all, because by and large, this oil is going to be pumped, you know, from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico and exported. So what's the point? And they're very vociferous about this. And the president has said very clearly that he believes that this should be addressed by his administration on its own merits and should not be judged by Congress.
Well, we're going to get into a little more on this issue and some historical perspective coming up after 3:30. Now, though, let's move on to immigration. The president now it looks like is going to make announce some executive action on immigration tomorrow. He may bar deportation for, I've seen different numbers, maybe 5 million undocumented immigrants. What are Republicans in Congress saying about this?
They're preparing to go bananas. They believe he is overreaching his authority. They believe he is offering amnesty to millions of people that he doesn't have a right to give. You know, we had an interview today with Senator Tom Coburn, an outgoing Republican from Oklahoma, who said basically he thinks there's going to be, you know, civil disobedience and even riots in the streets because Obama is undermining the rule of law. I think that's possibly the far edge of hyperbole, but you know, the Republicans are mad about this, and one of the things they're suggesting is that they might try and shut down the government rather than fund Obama's plan to create more leeway for undocumented immigrants.
Can they do that even during this lame duck session? I mean, with their control of the House and a filibusterable number in the Senate?
Yeah, they probably can, because what would end up – I mean – first of all, the Republicans don't want to shut down the government either. That's the problem. There's going to be a big split in their caucus. What they could do in theory is, because again, the government runs out of money December 11th. Idea has been all along that this lame duck session they'll pass some kind of spending bill for next year. Well, what they might do now is simply attach a sentence to that spending bill that says, thou shalt not spend any of this money to implement any of your executive actions on immigration. Of course, they'd have to word it a little differently than that, but
right.
Basically that's the gist of it. And then you get into this question, would Obama sign such a bill? Would he veto such a bill? What would having it? That's when you get to the shutdown showdown. And it could be very exciting, which is a bummer because the rest of us really want to take the holidays off.
Well, it'll keep you busy and keep people reading the paper during this. Well, short of a shutdown, I mean, you mentioned Tom Coburn talking about rioting the streets, but I've also seen words like lawsuits occasionally.
Yep.
Again, impeachment, that sort of thing. Are there other alternatives short of or maybe beyond shutdown?
Well, sure. I mean, there's smaller things they could do. I mean, beyond the shutdown, they could add, certain programs they will not fund. They could, Congress can pass small legislation, but again, whether it gets signed is hard to imagine. They could, they could basically refuse to pass other bills Obama wants in exchange. They could hold up, trade agreements, that kind of stuff. It is always possible that someone starts an impeachment conversation or somebody, the Republicans have voted for a lawsuit against Obama for extending beyond his executive authority. We have not seen that move anywhere yet, but they could still pursue that. But again, those are sort of, that's the Hail Mary stuff. That's the stuff that's hard to do, and it's hard to figure out what precedent they have for it. The stuff that's relatively easy to do, the stuff they do have precedent for, they have the power of the purse.
Let's talk about that purse a little more. We're at, we haven't been hyping the phrase enough lately, another fiscal cliff, though I don't think anybody has been thinking we'd go over it until this immigration thing. Remind us how
right.
we got here. What's at stake in this budget extension that we'd be doing?
Yeah, well, the whole idea, you recall at the fiscal cliff, they were basically organized a couple of years worth of spending plan to keep the government open and operating. After the last shutdown, they decided it was time to sort of work this out. The problem is that every year the government runs out of money in September. That's the budget cycle. And Congress has to approve new spending before the government can continue operating. And if they fail to do so by the 1st of October, the government has to shut down. So what they did before they left town for the elections is they passed a short-term extension till December 11th, saying, okay, well, we'll take this up when we get back. And again, the theory at the time was it would be fairly easy to pass a year-long bill that will get us to next September. That's now looking less likely. One of the solutions they could come to on this front is they could pass a short-term spending bill that goes into, say, February or March, let the new Congress get sworn in and take power, and then the Republican Senate has a stronger hand to force changes on Obama. That's another possibility.
So with this immigration thing, there's some talk like, okay, Republicans control Congress. Obama's still mm-hmm. in the White House. The lines of negotiation are clear. Maybe there's room to get things done. Republicans have been saying with this immigration thing, Obama's sending a message that he doesn't want to work together. So are we going to see no compromise, no negotiation come next year?
Your guess is as good as mine. I guess you'll just have to keep reading the paper. That's really the question here, right? The Republicans are saying that with this immigration action, Obama is essentially saying, buzz off, I don't want to work with you. And their response may very well be, fine, we're going to take our marbles and go home. We're not working with you either. And it becomes a standoff. But on the other hand, I think that you will discover there are areas where they actually do agree and they want to get stuff done together, whether it's, extending terrorism insurance for large construction, whether it is, passing a trade deal with Asian countries, stuff like that Republicans actually want to do. They cut off their own nose if they just tell the president, we're not going to work with you.
And how are Republicans looking to close out the year as they look ahead to their majority next year?
Well, I think it really depends. I honestly can't tell you what's going to happen in the next 48 hours. I think everything is now on hold as we wait to resolve this question of what Obama does on immigration and how much of it Republicans will flat out reject. That is, I think, now the entire agenda for at least the foreseeable future. The whole idea is Congress leaves town tomorrow. What day is today? Wednesday? Yeah. Congress leaves town tomorrow, possibly Friday morning. They're gone through Thanksgiving. They don't even come back till the first week of December. So, in theory, everything's on hold until we figure out how mad they are about this immigration thing.
All right, Paul, we've gotten through all of this without me asking you how this is going to affect elections in 2016. Let's leave it that way for now.
We'll save that till the holidays.
Excellent. Paul, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Be well.
That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to help make sense of what's going on in Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in a few moments, the Keystone Pipeline debate is one in a long series of conflicts over technology, energy, and development in the United States. A resident historian gives us some historical perspective.
First, the latest installment in a WPR series on death in America. Fewer than 30% of all Americans have filled out an advance directive outlining their health care wishes at the end of life. But that's not the case in La Crosse, where more than 90% of people who die have an advance directive or similar plan. Raymond Tungekar from To the Best of Our Knowledge visited La Crosse to find out why so many residents plan out their last days.
Well, my feeling is that, you know, if God's going to take me, it's time to go. And if I'm stuck on some machine, that's not God.
I have a few more questions for you. These questions will help you talk about your goals and values.
Here in this room, groups of healthcare professionals are acting out sensitive conversations between family members about what kind of treatment they want to receive near the end of their lives. It's surprising how informal it is.
Have you had experience with family or friends who became seriously ill or injured? For example, I know you've mentioned it was your mother, right?
This exercise is part of an advanced care planning program run by a local hospital here called Gunderson Health. This week, it's drawn doctors and nurses from all over the country, some even as far away as Japan and Hong Kong. And they're here to learn how La Crosse has been able to get its residents to plan out their end-of-life wishes.
I hear again and again, people won't talk about this. I think that's completely wrong. I think people don't know how to talk about this. And I think the trouble is, in any of our families, when we talk about important issues, we fear conflict, we fear disagreement.
Bud Hammes is a medical ethicist who started the program more than 20 years ago. Back then, most people in La Crosse hadn't filled out an advance directive. That's a legal document detailing their end-of-life wishes. Bud says every day he'd see people at the hospital struggling with painful life and death decisions.
In these cases, we saw families suffer from uncertainty. For some people, this is a lifelong burden they have to bear. I made a decision. My dad died. I don't know if I made the right decision. That's a horrible burden for any human to bear.
Bud wanted to help, so he asked around, made a few phone calls, and found that what people really needed, more than anything, was help talking with their families. And so he developed a program to walk people through these difficult conversations. A facilitator brings together family members and asks a series of open-ended questions. But really, they're just there to listen about a patient's fears, beliefs, and eventually, their end-of-life wishes.
When at least these conversations are done well, I think not only is it a positive experience for the family, but what they're in fact saying at the end is that they love each other. And now they know how to care for each other, even when they have a serious medical problem.
By now, thanks in part to Bud Hammes and Gunderson Health, most people in the town have talked with their families. In fact, more than 90% of the people who die here have some form of advance directive. That's nearly three times higher than the national average.
On almost a weekly basis here in La Crosse, someone thanks me. And they'll say, well, my mom died recently. And my family had this wonderful conversation. And because of that conversation with my mom, we knew what my mom wanted. So we feel, you know, that we took good care of her. And we all stayed on the same page. We didn't have any fighting or conflict during that very difficult time for our family. That, to me, is the greatest reward for all this work.
I have a few more questions for you. These questions will help you talk about your goals.
That was Bud Hammes speaking about advanced care planning in La Crosse. Their story is part of To the Best of Our Knowledge's five-part series on death and dying. You can hear the second hour today after 6.
The controversial Keystone XL pipeline went to a vote over the last several days, with the House voting yes, the Senate falling short of bringing it to a vote by one vote.
Central Times resident historian Jonathan Pollack joins us now to put that vote in historical context. John is a history instructor at MATC. John, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Well, you had an epiphany a long time ago about the friction point between American progress and the price of that progress. When you were just a kid, I guess you were thinking big thoughts even back then. You were thinking about the Alaskan pipeline.
Tell us that story. Well, this one, it was kind of a smaller thought because I was a smaller guy. So the epiphany sort of came up later. But when I was little, I was really obsessed with cars. And so my dad had a coworker who had car magazines. He subscribed to a few of them, and when he was done with them, he'd bring them into my dad, and my dad would bring them home, and I'd look at the pictures of cars. And I kind of absorbed a lot of stuff along the way, and one of the things I absorbed from looking at the ads and so forth for gas stations, for oil companies in the mid-70s, was that there was this pipeline in Alaska that was going to get the U.S. out of the energy crisis of the 1970s. Because this was like, when I go back and I think about, you know, what like capital H historical event do I remember earliest, it was the energy crisis starting in 1973 and kind of, you know, going in fits and starts through the 70s, that this was a big deal. Gas was hard to get. The price of gasoline skyrocketed. People began insulating their homes and being very worried about insulation and so on. And so the oil companies that sponsor the pipeline kind of talked about this. They mentioned there's all this oil up in Alaska, and we got this pipeline, and we're going to bring it down here. And I was like really excited about this. I thought, oh, this is going to be great when this pipeline gets here. And then I kind of went the other day. I was when you told me I was going to be on talking about the Keystone XL. I was looking at it, and I thought, oh, hey, wait a minute. That makes sense. The Alaska pipeline goes across the state of Alaska, that it starts at Prudhoe Bay up on the Arctic Sea and goes down to kind of Anchorage. And I had this – and it was kind of disappointing because as a kid I had this vision that it was like snaking all the way across Canada coming into the States. And no, it did no such thing. And then furthermore, whereas a kid, my memory of the Alaska pipeline was just like a great thing and it's a new day. It's done some kind of serious damage up in Alaska. There's been leaks along the way. It's had a huge impact on the environment up there. And so it's just another way that it's something I tell my students in most of my classes, that one of the things history does is it sort of robs you of your illusions as a little kid, that you sort of look in more detail at the context and so forth. And these things that seemed like unequivocally great ideas when you're small, you realize, oh, hey, there's a lot going on there. There's a whole other side of this. So when you mentioned I was coming on and talking about that, the Alaska pipeline was the first parallel I thought of, although obviously there's some things about it that are, you know, that are kind of different from Keystone. It, you know, it was within one state, within Alaska, that the end of the pipeline, the oil's loaded onto tankers and so forth, and doesn't go across international borders, doesn't go across the lower 48 and so on. But kind of an interesting context nonetheless. And the Alaska pipeline, I think because it was in Alaska at that time, it didn't seem to attract as much national controversy. Even looking back at the coverage from the time, wasn't as drawn out and deep a controversy as Keystone has been in the U.S. these last few years.
So from pipeline to pipeline and a lot of other points, you say this kind of highlights something that's been a core debate for at least a century in the United States, the value of progress versus the price of progress. Can you talk about that as the theoretical historical backdrop here?
Yeah, sure. So to go down that road, one of the things that I also talk about in the classes I teach and that I think is kind of a characteristic of American culture generally, is that the U.S. is built on short-term thinking. The U.S. is great at that. It's what we do best. If you're trying to figure out how to make more money this quarter, then this is what American firms are set up to do. This is what American culture is focused on. It's focused on what is new, what is different, what has changed, and so on. And if you ask the questions, well, what's the effect of this going to be down the road? The answer for many quarters in American culture is stop it. Stop getting in the way. You know, we're trying to get stuff done here. Quit asking all these questions. We'll figure it out later. And we talk about the history of the environmental movement and why Keystone is one in a series of controversies coming out of an environmental awareness, is that environmentalism, of course, kind of calls all that into question. That to live in a green fashion, however we define that, whether it's just a matter of buying a hybrid car instead of a conventional engine car, or whether it's putting solar panels on your roof, or driving less and biking everywhere and so forth, whatever degree we interpret our environmental consciousness, it always involves this kind of waiting for a minute and thinking about what's the consequence of this. And American history doesn't have that many examples of it, except in response to crisis. So the first, for example, some of the beginnings of the modern environmental movement began in industrial centers, kind of a Pittsburgh in particular, being in a valley and being kind of a smokestack-oriented city. Pittsburgh was nicknamed the Smoky City. That was its nickname. And Pittsburghers were proud of this because to Pittsburgh, around the turn of the century, smoke was progress. There's all these factories going 24 hours a day. This is Pittsburgh was a city that was on the up and up and that was getting things done. But reformers at that time began to notice, especially public health folks, noticed this big uptick in people with asthma, which at that time was really a dread disease. It was very hard to manage. I noticed all kinds of sickness coming from the smoke in the city all the time. And so they began to, well, is there a way we can regulate the smoke? Is there a way we can cut back on the smoke? And to bring this to the leaders of the Smoky City, it's an outrage. How dare you question the value of smoke? And so forth. So it kind of begins there. And we look at other developments in the environmentalist movement. Environmentalism, by definition, kind of says, okay, we've got this now. What are the consequences? When we bring this forward to Keystone, to jump forward like 100-some years, we bring this forward to Keystone, again, our mindset about it is kind of like, I think for a lot of people, it's kind of like where I was like back in the 70s. It's like, great, oil is one of those things. It's always in short supply. There are periodic shortages. The price of gasoline skyrockets and so forth. In particular, in international affairs over the last 20 years, our oil comes out of politically unstable places. Tar sands oil comes out of Alberta, Canada. It's pretty peaceful up there. It's a pretty placid area. We're not worried about revolutions in that part of Western Canada. So it seems like it's all good. Let's get it out of there. But then the issue that comes up in response is, well, to get that oil out, it takes an enormous amount of water, which is also kind of increasingly in short supply. There's the after effects that the tar sands oil business already has deforested a good deal of Alberta in the area around the fields, that there's lots of particulates that are given off that are picked up by prevailing winds and dropped elsewhere. And so, again, the Keystone Project calls into our consciousness the effects of just getting our hands on more oil, which for a lot of people is really that's the whole point. That's a great idea. And then it's dealing with the consequences that becomes like, oh, wait a minute. Well, what do we do about that? How that interferes with our idea of getting it out as fast as possible. Uh-oh. Controversy ensues.
Do you see a parallel when you look at, say, DDT, another thing, a progressive, meaning it worked, a stronger pesticide, and then you turn around, you look at the effects, and it's not looking so good when you have to consider other consequences later on.
Exactly, yeah. That if we talk about agricultural chemicals and the environment movement relative to that, agricultural chemicals, this is a sign of progress, that one of the struggles in agriculture going back as far as humans have cultivated crops is protecting those crops against pests. DDT seemed to give farmers kind of almost like a nuclear attack against that, gave them like this huge weapon to hold off invasive species and so forth. Until it came out that it has all these effects on birds that fly through there also. It has these wide-ranging impacts that we didn't originally think of. That, again, the short-term thinking and very focused thinking, how do we get rid of pests? Boom, this chemical does the trick. And then it's later on that people discovered the impacts and kind of said, ouch, we need to, we need to watch how we use that as efficient as it might be as its basic task. So yeah, there's an echo of that in the Keystone case as well.
We're looking at this past week's congressional votes on the Keystone XL pipeline with some historical context.
Jonathan Pollack is with us. He's a history instructor at MATC and Central Times resident historian.
You can join the conversation. How do you think we should balance jobs, the environment, and economic development? Do you see the environment and economic growth, economic progress as opposites, or can they work together? How much progress is too much for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
After a long wait, the Keystone XL pipeline finally came up for a vote in Congress over the past several days. Got a yes from the House and a no from the Senate by one vote.
And you can join the conversation. We're talking more broadly. How do you weigh American progress against competing concerns, things like the environment? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Central Time's resident historian stays with us. Jonathan Pollack is a historian at MATC. He's giving us a big picture about environmental legislation competing with business interests and other things weighing against one another here in America. And Jonathan, another aspect of to all of this is jobs.
Yeah, so the jobs angle for Keystone has come in, that proponents of the pipeline have said that there'll be a bunch of jobs created. And as an aside, that's always kind of a tricky matter when there's a new business comes to town or a new mining operation, construction project. The question becomes, how do you define jobs? Do you look at just the people employed on the project itself? The same people working on the project will need places to live. They'll need places to shop and so forth. So there are spin-off jobs that are kind of created. And the story in the history of environmentalism, and especially the environmental movement around extractive industries like mining, like oil drilling and so forth, is always this kind of give and take that historically mining jobs and jobs in oil fields were jobs that were high paying. They were risky. They were pretty dangerous, but they were high paying. And you could learn the skills to do them in a fairly short amount of time. You didn't need a great deal of specialized education or training. And so in a lot of contexts, they were really desirable jobs that for many parts of the country, their economy was based on people getting jobs in extractive industries. Well, for the Keystone Project, at least in the United States, the jobs created would largely be temporary, that most of the jobs would be involved in the construction of it, which would be like a couple of years. And then after that, the number of people actually required to monitor the pipeline and so forth would kind of dwindle down into like the mid double digits. And this also follows, this is another kind of adjustment that's going on that I think is a really difficult one, that historically mining jobs, mines were, this was great. This was the center of the economy in northern Wisconsin, the UP, the Iron Range in Minnesota, as well as many other parts of the country. But as technological change has come along, and as the minerals or the products to be dug out of mines are more and more remote, then we're using higher technology. We're using technologies that let us get the same stuff out of the ground with fewer people. So in some ways, we want the argument to still be there, and that the heritage of many parts of the country is tied up in the history of mining, in the history of extractive industry. But the present-day technology of that is that we're not actually going to be using as many people that the technology has displaced a bunch of jobs.
Let's bring in a caller now. We've got Ivy on the line in Evansville. Ivy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just think operations like the Keystone just kicked the can down the road. We should be focusing on the decentralized energy and encouraging that rather than just continuing to fuel our lust for oil. And also, I don't know if people are aware of that oil pipeline break. I think it was in Arkansas where oil just flooded this neighborhood and marsh. And these people's homes were basically they can't live in them. And they were pretty much abandoned by Exxon, one of the richest companies in the world. And so my thought to say to people out there is, if you think it'll bring you a job, who's gonna when your house is tainted by the chemicals of that oil or a spill, you can't sell your house.
Gotcha, Ivy. I want to get John in to respond to the first point. First of all, saying focus on alternative energy now instead of the oil. And there's been talk, things like blue-green alliances trying to get labor and environmentalists together on sustainable energy jobs. Is that something that's faded from this current moment in history?
I think the blue-green alliance is in some trouble. Operating engineers and other unions involved in oil especially have been have been kind of focused on their legacy work in oil fields, in oil production and transport. And so they've not been that interested in entertaining alternatives, whereas other industries that are other energy industries that are coming online more recently in wind and solar, those industries are flourishing in a period where the labor movement is really kind of staggering, is really falling in terms of influence, falling in terms of numbers. Solar and wind industries are coming up in an environment where it's harder to organize a union. So they're not unionized. So those unions don't speak to them. They don't have a labor consciousness. So that alliance has proved like really elusive. To the caller's point about getting on and finding new sources of energy, yeah, this is a classic environmentalist kind of statement. This is exactly what the environmental movement advises us to do, is to think about the consequences down the line. As the caller pointed out, with a case in Arkansas, there's a similar case in Michigan, very close to where I grew up, of an oil line that ruptured and polluted the Kalamazoo River. And again, I think the environmental movement in some ways is carrying the day here, partly because the price of gas has fallen. One of the things that made the Alaska pipeline so compelling in the 70s was this constant upward mm-hmm. spiral. But now we're below $3 a gallon for gas. And for a lot of people, the need just isn't as urgent. They're not as anxious about the price of gas always going upward.
John, as always, thanks for joining us.